Australia is just starting to make sense of a deadly attack targeting people at the beach who were celebrating Hanukkah.
There was a feeling of this sort of thing just doesn't happen in Australia, but at the same time, a lot of Jewish Australians said, well, this is our worst nightmares realized.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Also today, Jimmy Lai, the media tycoon and democracy advocate in Hong Kong, has been found guilty under China's so-called national security law.
This verdict shows how far Hong Kong's once-respected legal system has been hollowed out and politicized.
How people in Turkey use coffee grounds to have their fortunes read. And our smartphones might not be as smart as we think.
The selling point of this piece of software is that you can type in virtually any phone number and it will be able to track it.
That's all ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for coming along today. Australia is in shock and mourning after a mass shooting that claimed at least 15 lives at a Hanukkah celebration on Sydney's iconic Bondi Beach. The alleged shooters were a father and son who reportedly pledged allegiance to ISIS. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said there's no evidence that the attackers were part of a terror cell.
At this time, we need to wrap our arms around members of the Jewish community who are going through an extraordinarily difficult period.
Rabbi Gabby Kaltman knew some of the victims. Here he is speaking to a news channel in Australia.
So many of us have backgrounds of fleeing persecution, pogroms, discrimination, the Holocaust, and coming to Australia to rebuild a better life. And for this to have happened on the shores of Bondi Beach is just unfathomable.
I spoke earlier today with Daniel Losoto, a reporter with the Sydney Morning Herald. He arrived at the scene after the shooting and spoke with witnesses about what they saw.
Obviously chaotic scenes, everyone, you know, running for their lives, really. A lot of confusion. A lot of people thought they were fireworks at first, the gunfire, because, you know, for several reasons, you don't expect that sort of thing to occur in Australia. But it also, you know, I like to think it brought out the best in a lot of people as well. You've seen a lot of sort of video of heroes wrestling the gun from one of the gunmen. A lot of people looking after one another and without doubt making sure that the death toll wasn't as high.
Absolutely. At the crime scene now, are you seeing people coming together after this terrible shooting has happened? I know it has turned into a memorial.
Yeah, so there's been a memorial established at the Bondi Pavilion. There's been Jewish people coming down to pray and to sing together, which has been a really nice sort of show of community connection in what is a devastating period. Mm-hmm. But a lot of things going on. A lot of people just going back to Bondi just to sort of actually understand what occurred on Sunday night. It felt very surreal to a lot of people enjoying their Sundays at the beach, as most of us do.
Mm. Australia has seen an alarming rise in anti-Semitic attacks since October 7th of 2023. How are leaders of Australia's Jewish community reacting to this shooting?
I think the whole community is devastated by the loss. And I think some leaders have chosen to sort of just at this moment open their arms and sort of make sure everyone is okay and safe in this moment. A couple of Jewish leaders stood up yesterday and called on the government to go further to stamp this out. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, appointed his first anti-Semitism envoy over the last couple of years, and she tabled a report in July to propose efforts to curb anti-Semitism. That report is yet to be formally responded to, but more efforts were announced yesterday to ensure security for Jewish people, for example, is better protected and things of that nature. So there are things underway, but yes, Jewish leaders definitely want more from this current government.
Are you hearing anger that more had not been done to prevent anti-Semitism in the recent past?
This has been a conversation, to your point, since October 7, really. We've seen instances of anti-Semitic graffiti outside Jewish schools, for example, and synagogues. We've seen, you know, a firebombing in Melbourne at the Adas synagogue. And we've seen similar spates of vandalism at Jewish places of worship in Sydney. It's been in the forefront of all Australians' minds, I think. But, you know, what happened on Sunday, some Jewish leaders have said, you know, it was their worst nightmare come true.
Mm.
Mass shootings don't occur often in Australia. So I think there was a feeling of this sort of thing just doesn't happen in Australia. But at the same time, a lot of Jewish Australians said, well, this is our worst nightmares realized.
Yeah. Are you hearing fear?
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, the sort of the dominant sentiment is one of sorrow and devastation. There's definitely been reports of Jewish Australians being scared to, you know, to go outside, to go to work, to go to school. For example, there was a police presence outside a Jewish school not far from Bondi for the school day.
Are other synagogues, Jewish community centers, schools increasing security?
Yeah, the New South Wales police have upped their presence at places of worship and schools. I imagine that will continue for at least the coming week, and schools do break up soon for Christmas. You know, I'm sure that will be sort of fluid and monitored as the weeks go by.
How large is Australia's Jewish population?
In Sydney, there's a Jewish diaspora across all of Sydney, but there is a concentration in the eastern suburbs where Bondi is. And Bondi itself is quite a large Jewish community. There's several synagogues in the area. Certainly a strong and lively population, which is part of our lovely multicultural nation.
Australia is known for its strict gun laws, which has been especially true since the 1990s. Can you remind us what happened then that triggered these tight gun laws?
In 1996, there was the Port Arthur massacre. Port Arthur is a site in Tasmania. Sadly, there were 35 killed and 24 injured in that awful massacre. That led to then Prime Minister John Howard ushering in new gun reforms. One of the things was a big buyback scheme, which brought guns out of the hands of, I guess, regular Australians, if you like, and put them, well, not even the government's hands, but they were destroyed. So that was a big sort of push, and that's been celebrated across the world, especially in America. It's sort of always sort of trumpeted as a legislative method to reduce the likelihood of mass shootings. So that's been in place for almost 30 years now and been widely celebrated in Australia. That being said, Sajid Akram, one of the shooters, legally held 6 firearms. He was part of a recreational gun club in Western Sydney. And already Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has signaled tougher gun laws are going to be on the way.
Do you have any idea what that might look like? Are there any specifics around that statement yet?
No legislation has been drafted quite yet, though the respective parliaments have signaled a desire to meet again as soon as possible. You appreciate it's December and it's coming up to Christmas, so the normal calendar means that they've broken for the summer, but there's a good chance that we come back early to pass these laws. One of the things will be tackling this in perpetuity problem, whereby if you get a gun license, you don't have to actually reapply for a gun license. So there'll be some sort of stopgap measure, which means that if you have a gun license, you have to regularly appear before some sort of regulatory body and make it clear that you have not become radicalized, for example. And there will also be measures around using criminal intelligence to reject a gun license application as opposed to simply a criminal record. And also toughening laws insofar as only Australian citizens can access a legal firearms license.
Are you hearing anything from Muslim leaders? I can imagine there could be some fear of backlash.
There has been some fear of retribution. The New South Wales Premier, Chris Minns, and the New South Wales Police Commissioner have been very clear to warn the public against vigilantes. That is a key concern of them. To answer your question, Muslim elites have been very clear in their condemnation of these two people. All Australians have been, very clear in supporting that community in what is an awful time.
Is there concern that public debate in Australia might become divided over these events, either, gun control or over religious identity issues?
I suppose, if we were to take a look back at the history books, what turned out to be very successful gun reform following the Port Arthur massacre was met with a substantial level of backlash from farmers and people in the agricultural and regional sector who didn't want to necessarily return their rifles. If we were to use that as a bit of a yardstick, it might suggest that there might be some backlash moving forward. I would expect there to be a level of, certainly consultation, and hopefully it's peaceful and sensible. And at the end of the day, these laws will be drafted to keep Australians safe. So I think most Australians can sort of understand the need for them.
Daniel Losoto is a reporter with the Sydney Morning Herald. Lots of small towns across Europe are struggling. Young people have moved to big cities. Jobs are hard to find. Rural Spain is no different, except in one way, and now has its own rock band putting words and music to life in the sticks. The new trio is called Sanguijuelas del Guadiana. The World's Jerry Haddon reports from Barcelona.
Victor, Juan, and Carlos, childhood pals who started out with gigs like this.
Thank you.
playing traditional songs, this one's a paso doble, in their hometown orchestra, deep in the hills of Spain's sparsely populated southwest. That was a decade ago. Today, the sanguijuelas, or leeches in English, have found their own sound. This song is called Brevolá. It tells the universal story of rural Spain, of young people, like them, packing up in search of a better life in places like Madrid or here in Barcelona. The lyrics go, I'll sing to you my sadness, how lucky you are to live where you were born. Flowers die if you don't water them. Each Sunday, it's back to the big city. That's how these three lived for years, coming home on weekends when they could, wishing they could stay. The downside of life here, says Carlos Canelada, lead singer and guitarist, is the lack of resources. You have to move away because of it, or because you can't find work doing what you want to do. Our town, Casas de Don Pedro, has around 1,000 residents, says keyboard player Juan Grande. Compared to a big city, there just aren't the opportunities here, he says. It's hard to meet people with the same interests. And yet, the guys are back home. They're speaking to me from the village in an old dance hall they've turned into their studio.
Tocábamos mucho en la calle, en el metro, tocábamos en...
In Madrid, we were busking on the streets a lot, says Canelada, or on the subway. Eventually, we started thinking of making an album. And when you're so far from home, you start thinking about all that you miss. So we decided it's time to go back. This song goes, take me back to Extremadura. That's the region they're from. And leave me in my homeland. Scatter me like seeds in the sky to nourish the harvests. If we all do this together, I'll never die. Sanguijuela's musical style reflects their travels. Their tunes mix techno and rock with flamenco melodies from closer to home. And on stage, says Cristina Calderón, they dazzle. Calderón started the band's fan club. Her family's from Casas de Don Pedro. One weekend there, she caught their very first show.
En el minuto uno en que yo les escuché, me giré a mis amigos y les dije, digo,
they'd barely started playing, and I turned to my friends and I say, excuse me, are you guys hearing this? I said, this band is going to be huge. If they keep this up, this is going to explode. And that's what happened, she says. In less than a year, Sanguijuelas has gone from playing at small-town outdoor events to selling out the biggest clubs across Spain. Calderón calls them the voice of this generation, a generation longing to hear about the good things and bad about small-town life. Bass player Victor Arroba lays out the good. Having your family and friends right there, he says. You don't have to take a bus for hours to see them. Life is just much calmer. You're never in a rush. Time may feel slower, but it does pass. And with each season, small-town Spain loses more people. In this song, the band sings, the years go rushing by, it dries out the flowers. In the village bars, fewer and fewer of us remain. I asked the band if their music is inspiring young people to move back to the countryside. Fans aren't telling us that they're actually moving home, says Grande, but they are starting to consider it, and that's already something. Sanguijuela says repopulating country villages isn't their aim, but if their music plants a seed, all the better. As for themselves, they say, they're home to stay. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
Up next, Chileans just elected their most right-wing president since the end of military rule 35 years ago. We'll hear what that means for the country. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Chile, José Antonio Kast was elected president on Sunday. The far-right candidate won a decisive victory against the center-left politician, Jeanette Jara. Kast campaigned on promises to be tough on crime and illegal immigration. Rosana Castiglione is a professor of political science at Diego Portales University in Santiago, Chile. She says this was Kast's third time running for president and that it was a combination of factors that enabled him to finally win.
He did a much better campaign. He avoided issues that could be divisive and could take some votes away from him, for example, value type of issues. The other one has to do with the poor performance of the government that is leaving.
So the opponent, Jeanette Jara, was seen kind of as a continuity vote. And because people didn't like how the current government is doing, you're saying they voted against her and for José Antonio Kast.
Yeah, absolutely. That was part of it. That was part of it. The third reason, I think, is that the right wing in general is much more credible when it talks about being very tough at fighting crime and controlling immigration, which was one of the main issues in the agenda.
So immigration and crime, you're saying he had credibility on. What exactly did he promise he was going to do on those two topics?
What he is saying is that all irregular immigrants are going to be deported.
All of them.
They're irregular. He said he's also going to reinforce the borders. And then in terms of crime, he was not very specific about the measures he was going to implement, but he said that it's going to be the top priority in the agenda.
And why did voters support those policies so thoroughly that he got elected by, what, 58%?
Well, crime has been topping the agenda for some time, which is quite paradoxical because Chile is one of the safest countries of Latin America. But what we have seen is new forms of crime, more violent crimes, for example, that we didn't see a few years ago. Then I think there has been a criminalization of immigration. So I think the public perception is that immigration is tied to violence and violent crimes, which is not really the case, but that has been politicized. So I think it's tied more to fear than to numbers.
And was that fear that Kast drummed up when he was campaigning?
Absolutely. And not only Kast, I would say the right wing, because there were three right wing candidates who campaigned on immigration and crime, and also the economy. Chile has been growing at a 2% rate for the past few years, which is low. And I think that's part of the reason also that he won the election.
Kast is the most far-right leader in Chile since the days of Augusto Pinochet. Kast has praised the late military dictator whose government was responsible for the deaths and torture of thousands of Chileans. I'm curious how that played into this election, how people were voting or just seeing this election.
So there is a very recent paper that says the cleavage that divided society, pro-dictatorship, anti-dictatorship, is fading away, and that there is a new sort of cleavage emerging that is related to the position that people took towards the constitutional process. So this traditional cleavage surrounding the coup d'etat is not that strong.
Can you describe the constitutional process you are referring to in a couple of more words?
Yeah, well, we had something that we call the social explosion, that was a wave of social mobilizations in Chile that ended when the party leaders of all the political parties, excepting the Communist Party, said that there was going to be a new constitution, a new constitutional process to write a constitution from scratch. So this process was quite traumatic. And at the end, it was not supported by the population.
So you're saying that people are less concerned when they go to the polls about a candidate's stance on Pinochet than they are on their stance of the process where the country almost adopted a new constitution that was much more recently, just a couple of years ago.
Exactly. People just wanted a change after that.
So are Chileans seeing this election as part of a larger regional trend in Latin America with voters shifting to the right?
I wouldn't say that this is exactly the same process that we have been seeing in other countries. Kast is not an outsider, first thing. He's a politician that has a lot of experience. He has been in Congress. He has been involved in politics for a very long time. And he shares many traits with the traditional right, although he's a new candidate in the sense that we never had a president that is in the really right wing and not center right. Mm.
Rosanna Castiglione is a political scientist at Diego Portales University. In Hong Kong today, the former media mogul and pro-democracy activist Jimmy Lai was found guilty of, quote, colluding with foreign forces to endanger national security and conspiracy to publish seditious articles. Lai was arrested in 2020 under a controversial national security law imposed by Beijing. The year before, Hong Kong saw massive pro-democracy protests, which Jimmy Lai took part in. Critics of the national security law say it undermines free expression in Hong Kong, as well as the principle of one country, two systems, which allowed Hong Kong to maintain a democratic system beyond the reach of mainland China. Jimmy Lai's newspaper, Apple Daily, was a symbol of that autonomy, publishing op-eds that sharply criticized the Chinese Communist Party and advocating for democracy. The paper was forced to shut down in 2021. Before his arrest, Lai told the Associated Press why he refused to leave Hong Kong, despite the danger of being arrested.
If I leave, not only I disgrace myself, I discredit Apple Daily and also undermine the solidarity of the democratic movement. I have to take responsibility.
Lai's trial was conducted without a jury, and he was not allowed to choose his own legal counsel.
This verdict shows how far Hong Kong's once respected legal system has been hollowed out and politicized.
Francis Hoy is with the Committee for Freedom in Hong Kong Foundation. This is Hoy speaking in a video posted on social media.
At his age, with his health in steep decline, any sentence risks becoming a life sentence in all but name.
Jimmy Lai is 78 years old. His daughter, Claire, wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post saying that her father has experienced severe weight loss while in detention and has developed several chronic ailments. Lai's son Sebastian is calling on British Prime Minister Keir Starmer to pressure China into releasing his father, who is a UK citizen. Here's the younger Lai speaking to the BBC.
I mean, the onus is really on the Prime Minister Keir to get him out, to be the factor that unlocks him and brings him home here to the UK with his family.
The judges in his case have not yet said when Jimmy Lai will be sentenced. Under Hong Kong's national security law, he could be handed a sentence of life in prison. We will be right back with you. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The smartphones most of us use every day are incredibly powerful for communicating, navigating, paying for things, sharing cute cat pictures. The list goes on. They're also being used, though, for deeply intrusive surveillance that users might be completely unaware of. A new investigation discovered that more than 10,000 people across the globe have been spied on using a new software unknown to the public and even many experts. Unlike the notorious Pegasus software, which has been blacklisted by the U.S., this program is not just being used by governments. It's also helping corporations and even some private citizens carry out some highly sophisticated spying. The radio program Reveal, along with the investigative newsroom Lighthouse Reports, dug into this for a year and a half. Here's Reveal's Michael Montgomery with the story.
Ever since finishing college a few years ago, Gabriel Geiger has been working as an investigative journalist in Europe. In that short time, he's developed a specialty covering the surveillance industry. Not surprisingly, Gabe spends a lot of time online trawling for secrets.
When you think about the internet, it's almost like an iceberg. And you have the top of the iceberg, the tip of the iceberg. That's everything that you can find on the internet via Google search.
Then there's the deep web, hidden parts of the internet that aren't indexed by standard search engines.
The sort of ocean beneath the iceberg.
So Gabe sees his job as something like an explorer, searching for mysterious creatures in the vast, uncharted ocean of the deep web.
My bosses would be very angry if they understood how much time I spend fishing and getting nothing out of it. But every once in a while, you find something that's actually pretty interesting.
That happened one evening in 2024. Gabe is at home on his living room couch, his laptop open and glowing. A colleague had given him a tip, the name of an obscure company that develops surveillance tools.
I look at their website and it looks like it's from the 2000s or something. You know, it's kind of rundown website, old web design.
Even the company's name, FirstWAP, seems obsolete. The WAP stands for Wireless Application Protocol, a mobile internet technology that was abandoned years ago.
I'm sort of poking around trying to find out more about this company, and I come across this set of data lying on the internet, unsecured. Downloading it takes quite a long time.
As the data slowly streams into his computer, Gabe sees phone numbers and geographic coordinates. They were collected by FirstWAP over a span of 8 years.
And it becomes sort of clear that something is being tracked or monitored. I don't know if it's consensual or not consensual, but, you know, there's numbers attached to geographic coordinates that are sort of changing over time.
Gabe is burning to figure out who is being tracked.
So I'm looking through these phone numbers and I see a +39 number. +39 is the country code of Italy, where my mom is from and I spent a lot of time in. So I was sort of, okay, well, let me try to identify this Italian phone number that I see here.
He plugs the number into a web service that can identify names, email addresses, and social media accounts.
And when I do that, I get the name Gianluigi Nuzzi. And I put that name into Google, and I see that Gianluigi Nuzzi is an Italian journalist, and not just any Italian journalist. He's quite a famous Italian journalist, and he's quite famous for his investigations into the Vatican, corruption at the Vatican. And when I saw that, I kind of realized that I think I stumbled across something really important here.
Gabe works all night downloading as much data as he can. It will eventually total 1.5 million lines with hundreds of columns. Along the way, he texts his boss, Lighthouse's managing director, Daniel Howden.
And I'm excited. I thought, oh, of course, he's going to be convinced. As soon as I show him this, he's going to be like, wow, like, good job, you know?
So he gets Daniel on the phone.
It's still incredibly early. It's like, you know, pre-coffee hour.
It's 7 a.m. on a Sunday.
And Gabe is so excited. He's zealous. I mean, he's found something. I found the new Pegasus. I found our Pegasus. Obviously talking about this massive surveillance spyware investigation that went all over the world. And my first thought is like, this is going to be a good laugh for everyone over beers for weeks to come. He is full of this kind of puppyish enthusiasm. And I kind of pat him on the head a little bit, calm him down, and ask him a few questions.
Questions like, how is this different from the last three massive scoops that Gabe brought in?
Which turned out not to be what we thought.
Daniel knows from experience that it can take months, even years, to unravel a complex data set. And even then, there might not be a story. He's also concerned that the information Gabe has dug up is old. The data trails off in 2015. Editor and reporter Crofton Black is also cautious of Gabe's discovery.
He's young enough and like naive enough to think that he can take 1.5 million row data set and turn it into a story just like that.
Still, something about all this is intriguing to Crofton. I mean, it's just so much data. So he shares a sample with some trusted sources in the telecoms industry.
They were pretty stunned by the size of the data. You know, they were like, how did you get 1.5 million rows of this? You know, it's floated up from the depths of the deep web. It's like the Kraken.
The Kraken, you know, the legendary sea monster.
You know, you can measure it, you can weigh it, you can count how many tentacles it's got, you can, like, how many eyes has it got. But you don't have a guide, you know, you don't have Jacques Cousteau to tell you actually what it does, what it is.
2 months after Gabe discovers the Kraken, Lighthouse decides to move forward with the investigation. 13 other newsrooms join the Lighthouse team. They include Paper Trail Media from Germany, whose founders broke the Panama Papers investigation. With Crofton and Gabe tag-teaming as the famous ocean explorer Jacques Cousteau, they begin the tedious work of putting names and stories to many of those phone numbers. And while they're not able to trace all the numbers, what they find is pretty startling. A broad range of people from more than 100 countries, including the U.S., all being tracked on their mobile phones.
You see heads of state, you see award-winning journalists, you see human rights activists, you see leaders in industry, you see people inside the surveillance industry itself. It's this sort of extraordinary cross-section of important people doing important things in their lives all over the world.
Turns out that FirstWAP, the company that makes the technology, has been around for 2 decades. But some surveillance experts, they've never heard of it.
I was not familiar with this company.
Ron Diebert is an author, cyber sleuth, and director of Citizen Lab, the digital human rights group based in Toronto. He says the fact that he hadn't heard about FirstWAP isn't really a surprise.
It's a relatively crowded space. There are many companies that have been able to operate in the shadows, which I think says something about this sector as a whole.
As the Lighthouse team begins to make sense of the data, it also obtains company documents, marketing material, and connects with former employees. A picture emerges of this mysterious company, FirstWAP, and the software it developed to track all those phone numbers. They learn the software's name, Altimedes, and what it stands for. Advanced Location Tracking, Mobile Information, and Deception System.
And the selling point of this piece of software is that you can type in virtually any phone number and it will be able to track it anywhere in the world with no trace on the phone.
Altimedes doesn't leave a trace because unlike spyware like Pegasus, it doesn't get inside your phone.
It's important to remember that our devices, our smartphones, sit on and function through a broader telecommunications ecosystem, which itself has been for decades notoriously insecure and poorly regulated. They can exploit these signaling protocols in order to package up a service that is not quite the same as getting inside a device, but can accomplish a lot.
Altimedes works in a couple ways. If a customer, say a government, wanted to track a phone number, they could buy a system and run it themselves through a local phone network. Another way the software works is through a web-based portal. It taps into the global phone network through telecom companies in Liechtenstein or Indonesia. And it's not just about tracking someone's movements. Altimedes also makes it possible to listen in on voice calls, read texts, and hijack communications on encrypted platforms like WhatsApp. In its marketing materials and in a response to the reporting team, FirstWAP says Altimedes was developed to help governments fight serious crime and track down terrorists. That's a common refrain in the surveillance industry. But many of the phone numbers from FirstWAP's own database challenge that narrative. And this is where Italian investigative journalist Gianluigi Nuzzi comes back into the picture. In May 2012, Nuzzi's blockbuster book about Pope Benedict XVI was getting worldwide attention.
This morning, an author is defending his explosive allegations against the Vatican. His new book accuses powerful members of the church hierarchy of greed and financial mismanagement.
Nuzzi's book drew on leaked documents, including private correspondence between Pope Benedict and his secretary. Crofton says the Holy See was irate.
At this moment in time, Gianluigi Nuzzi was the Vatican's public enemy number one. He was the guy who was splashing all their dirty secrets and hanging out their dirty laundry to an enormous audience in Italy. And they wanted to know where he got the stuff.
We know at the time from reporting that there's a sort of mad hunt to uncover who Nuzzi's source is, who's inside the Vatican leaking all these documents to him.
Gabe took a closer look at the data he discovered.
And I'm looking at the dates, and I realize Nuzzi is being tracked just days after he publishes his big book.
Gabe says the data shows Nuzzi was tracked for about a week. Then, the day after the Vatican police arrested his source, the tracking suddenly stopped.
A scandal worthy of a Hollywood blockbuster is rocking the Vatican. The detention of Pope Benedict's butler capped one of the most convulsive weeks in recent Vatican history.
The butler, Paolo Gabriele, was charged with stealing the Pope's private papers and leaking them. He was convicted by a Vatican court and sentenced to 18 months in prison. Nuzzi was also indicted.
Defendant Gianluigi Nuzzi arrives for the first day of a Vatican trial over the alleged theft of confidential documents from the Holy See.
After years of legal wrangling, Nuzzi and another reporter were finally acquitted. Fast forward about 9 years to July 2025. Nuzzi is approached by the Lighthouse team. Like most people who show up in the tracking data, he has absolutely no idea he was being monitored. In a noisy cafe, they show him a map on a laptop with dots indicating all the locations where he was tracked, like his home in Milan.
He's sort of zooming in at one of the points. Oh, that's my apartment. And they were tracking him everywhere he was going, while he was at the airport, while he was on a train or driving. They'd sort of scheduled the tracking every hour. So he was systematically being tracked as he moved across Italy.
Nuzzi is surprised at the precision with which he was tracked, but he's also circumspect. Crofton says he didn't want to jump to any conclusions that it was the Vatican that was behind the surveillance.
He was like, well, you know, it's not really their style. Like, I would expect them to be sending, you know, people to follow my car or like people to break into my house, maybe.
Then there's a breakthrough in the investigation. Lighthouse obtains emails and documents that show there is a connection to the Vatican. Here's what they learned. A British company, KCS Group, was acting as a middleman for First Web. They were preparing a pitch to the Vatican, showing them how they could use Altimedes. Crofton says KCS was planning to ask the Vatican which phone numbers they should monitor.
4 days after they asked that, we see that Nuzzi's numbers start being tracked. Then another 5 days later, KCS has their meeting with officials from the Vatican. KCS's employee goes to the meeting and he's got a presentation that shows on a map Nuzzi's movements over the last week. After the meeting, the employee from KCS, he actually emails First WAP saying, presentation fine, client happy.
We sent First WAP and KCS Group a detailed list of questions about how the Altimedes software was used to track Nuzzi. First WAP responded, saying it does not provide tracking services and that they aren't involved with how its product is used once it's delivered to a client. KCS Group says they have not been involved in selling or using inappropriate surveillance materials. Today, Gianluigi Nuzzi believes the Vatican was tracking him, and he's disturbed by it. He says he's still angry over the jailing of his source. He believes his only crime was exposing corruption.
It was a shock to me, because the Vatican never arrested pedophile priests. They never arrested money launderers. Money laundering was not even a crime. But they arrested a family man with a clean record who had committed the terrible crime of making photocopies and give it to a journalist.
You can really tell over the course of that interview that he's genuinely disturbed. He sort of felt that this showed the chilling effect that this type of technology can have on the work of journalists like himself and other journalists all around the world.
So if the Vatican tracked Nuzzi, were they breaking the law? Well, the Vatican is its own state, and it wouldn't necessarily be illegal to track someone within the walls of Vatican City. But Nuzzi was tracked outside the Vatican, in Rome, in Milan, all over Italy. To do that legally, the Vatican would need to make a formal request to Italian authorities. We asked the Vatican if they made a deal with KCS to use the Altimeter software. We also asked whether they made a request to Italian authorities to track Nuzzi. They never responded.
That's Michael Montgomery from the radio program Reveal. It's not just the rich and famous who've been spied on using this new software. Seemingly random people's movements have been tracked as well.
You can understand why a journalist investigating the Vatican is being tracked. It's not good, obviously, but why is a therapist inside there? That's a bigger mystery.
Catch the second part of our series from Reveal on tomorrow's show. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Turkish coffee is strong stuff. If you've ever had it, you know there's an art to not accidentally drinking the heaps of coffee grounds that collect at the bottom of the cup. Now, for centuries, that grainy sediment has been used in the art of fortune-telling. As tradition has it, if you turn the cup upside down and make a wish, there is meaning to be found in the way the coffee grounds slide down the sides of the cup. A new generation of fortune readers are now reviving this custom. Last fall, correspondent Duri Buscarin set out to see how Gen Z is putting its own spin on this old practice in Istanbul.
The Hypnos Fall Cafe is on the second floor of an old house, across from a dentist's office and a coffee shop.
It's more mysterious.
More like literally a house.
I visit the fortune teller with Gamze Yilmazel, an interpreter. While we might have expected something a bit dark or mystical, we're greeted by 26-year-old Doğukan Ürgün and his teacup chihuahua, Paris. We sit at a table overlooking the balcony. In Turkish, a fortune is known as a fal. Professional fortune tellers work out of fal cafes, where the price of a coffee includes a consultation. Ürgün, who goes by Zeus professionally, runs the cafe with his mother, Deniz Çoban. They read coffee grounds, tarot cards, even ripples and water.
Yani negatif şeylerin çıkma ihtimalinin bence daha yüksek olduğu bir fal olarak ben görüyorum.
Coffee fortune telling is a bit more of a dark thing because you can see more negative stuff as well. And people who do the coffee readings usually at some point they come to a point where they say, I don't want to do this anymore.
The origins of coffee reading aren't completely clear. But by the 16th century, there are historical references to women in the Ottoman palaces hiring professional fortune tellers to read their grounds. Even today, most Turks have an auntie or grandma who learned how to do it from their grandmother. Ürgün's mother, Deniz, sees the practice as a kind of therapy, a moment for some introspection.
Buraya genelde canı sıkılan geliyor, üzüntülü olan, karamsar olan.
Because mostly people come here while they're like rather desperate or sad or upset, but we want people to come here and feel better while leaving.
This very personal tradition has also entered the digital age. Popular smartphone apps allow users to upload a photo of their used coffee cup to be read by a professional teller or an AI program. Perhaps the most popular app is called Faladin. When I called the founder, Sertaç Taşdelen, he was at a wellness conference in Japan.
The way we look at it, it's pure entertainment.
Taşdelen was inspired by his mother, Binaz, who worked as a professional fortune teller. Since the app launched in 2012, Faladin has grown to provide more than a million AI-generated fortunes every day in seven different languages.
We all are actually not really complex emotional beings. We all want the same thing at a certain age. We all want to get married at one stage. We all want to have a good career. We all want to make money. So we use the scientific data to, you know, leverage on this commonality and create a very humanly story.
Other apps, including another one created by Taşdelen, hire real-life fortune tellers to read coffee grounds for users in real time. Some fortune tellers offer their services online, advertising on TikTok and Instagram. As online fortune telling goes mainstream, Ürgün says it's actually made the old fortune telling cafes more popular.
Bence aynı zevki vermiyor ve insanlar hatta onu yaptıktan sonra daha çok.
When people realize that they can do this online with people that they don't even see face to face, they don't know, they wanted to do it in person as well.
That's exactly what brought three friends, Ada, Nisa, and Celine, to another fortune-telling cafe in Istanbul.
Hayatımızda bir şey olunca, bir sorun olunca, merak ettiğimiz bir şey olunca hemen.
Ada says when something happens in our lives, when we have a problem, we get curious. Ada and her friends are pharmacy students. They ask not to use their last names because this is kind of a private thing. For Ada, this is her second time having her fortune read in person.
Bunlardan mesela yazın çok sıkılmıştık evde oturmaktan, görüntülü arıyorduk birbirimizi.
Over the summer, when we had nothing to do, she says, I went crazy and downloaded like 4 apps just to see what they would say. But Ada doesn't take them too seriously. There's a saying in Turkey, don't live by the fortune, but don't go without it.
Bence eskiden fal daha ciddi bir şeydi, eski kuşaklara göre.
It was a more serious thing in the olden days, says her friend Nisa. But with all of the apps, I think there are more liars around. People are just trying to make money off of it. A third friend, Celine, decided not to have a reading.
Biraz korkuyorum. Böyle hem kötü bir şey duymaktan çekiniyorum hem de...
I'm a bit afraid, she says, that I'll learn bad things, or that I'll get obsessed about the things that I hear and live according to it. Back at the Hypnose Fall Cafe, I decide to have a go at it. Dokan Ergun brews a stiff cup of Turkish coffee for me. When I'm finished drinking it, he shows me how to place the saucer on top before turning the cup upside down.
Bunu böyle üstüne kapatıyorsun.
Okay.
Evet, ondan sonra.
My heart starts to jump a bit. It's either nerves or caffeine. When the coffee cup is cool to the touch, I'm called into a back room. His mother, Deniz Çoban, asks my name, birth date, if there's anyone special in my life. Picking up my cup, she looks at the dark streaks and curls lining the sides, and she begins.
Annesiyle babası ayrı.
Are my parents divorced? Yes.
Ve 7-8 yaşlarından sonra da aslında...
She tells me things about my childhood, my romantic life, even the zodiac signs of my parents.
Ama baba da terazi, ikizler terazi, kova.
If your father was something maybe like a Taurus, your mom was probably a Libra or something like that, and the conflict between their zodiac signs, the energy, also affected your life in general. Maybe you could get into a healing process in terms of that.
That's not completely accurate, but she did hit the nail on the head with some things that are pretty personal, and that I'm going to need to think about for a while. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
We're going to leave you today with a message of hope from Rokia Kone. She's a musician from Mali in West Africa who we featured on the show before. This song is called Nyan Nyan. It's based on an old tune passed down over time, and it reminds listeners that bad things do not go on forever. Rokia Kone recorded the track in one take on a night when everything around her seemed to be in upheaval. It was August of 2020 when there was a coup in Mali, giving extra meaning to the lyrics, "Things may be bad now, but it's only a moment in time." Music there from Mali's Rokia Kone. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Mann and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and also on YouTube. We're at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Come back again and join us tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. And by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.
From PRX.